"Might help," Tengo said. "Are you saying that if I remember something about her, I might get a hint about where she is hiding?" Without answering, she gave a little shrug. The gesture might have contained an affirmative nuance. "Thank you," Tengo said. Fukaeri gave him a tiny nod, like a contented cat. Tengo prepared lunch in the kitchen. Fukaeri was intently choosing records from the record shelf. Not that he had a lot of records there, but it took her time to choose. At the end of her deliberations, she took out an old Rolling Stones album, put it on the turntable, and lowered the tone arm. It was a record that he had borrowed from somebody in high school, and for some reason never given back. He hadn't heard it in years. Listening to tracks like Mother's Little Helper and Lady Jane, he made rice pilaf using ham and mushrooms and brown rice and miso soup with tofu and wakame. He boiled cauliflower and flavored it with curry sauce he had prepared. He made a green bean and onion salad. Cooking was not a chore for Tengo. He always used it as a time to think, about everyday problems, about math problems, about his writing, or about metaphysical propositions. He could think in a more orderly fashion while standing in the kitchen and moving his hands than while doing nothing. Today, however, no amount of thinking would tell him what kind of special place Fukaeri had been talking about. Trying to impose order on something where there had never been any was a waste of effort. The number of places he could arrive at was limited. The two of them sat across from each other eating dinner. Their conversation was virtually non-existent. Like a bored married couple, they transported the food to their mouths in silence, each thinking, or not thinking, separate thoughts. It was especially difficult to distinguish between the two in Fukaeri's case. When the meal ended, Tengo drank coffee and Fukaeri ate a pudding she found in the refrigerator. Whatever she ate, her expression never changed. Chewing seemed to be the only thing she was thinking about. Tengo sat at his desk, and following Fukaeri's suggestion, he tried hard to recall something about Aomami. "You remember some things about her. One of them might help." But Tengo could not concentrate. Another Rolling Stones record was playing. Little Red Rooster, a performance from the time Mick Jagger was crazy about Chicago blues. Not bad, but not a song written for people engaged in deep thinking or in the midst of seriously digging through old memories. The Rolling Stones were not a band much given to such kindness. He needed some place quiet where he could be alone. "I'm going out for a while," Tengo said. Studying the Rolling Stones album jacket in her hand, Fukaeri nodded, as if to say, "Fine." "If anyone comes here, don't open the door for them," Tengo said. Tengo walked toward the station wearing a navy blue long-sleeved t-shirt, chinos from which the crease had long since faded, and sneakers. Just before reaching the station, he turned into a bar called Barleyhead and ordered a draft beer. The place served drinks and snacks. It was small enough so that 20 customers filled it up. He had come here any number of times before. Young people made it quite noisy late at night, but there were relatively few customers in the hour between 7 and 8, when the mood was nice and hushed. It was perfect for sitting alone in a corner and reading a book while drinking a beer. The chairs were comfortable, too. He had no idea where the bar's name came from or what it meant. He could have asked one of the employees, but he was not good at small talk with strangers, and not knowing the source of the name didn't really matter. It was just a pleasant bar that happened to be named Barleyhead. Fortunately, no music was playing. Tengo sat at a table by a window, drinking Carlsberg draft and munching on mixed nuts from a small bowl, thinking about Aomami. Picturing Aomami meant that Tengo himself became a 10-year-old boy again. It also meant that he experienced a major turning point in his life once again. After Aomami grasped his hand when they were 10, he refused to make any more rounds with his father doing NHK subscription collections. Shortly after that, he experienced a definite erection and his first ejaculation. That was a watershed in his life. Of course, the transformation would have come, sooner or later, whether or not Aomami grasped his hand. But Aomami urged him on and promoted the change as if she had given his back a gentle shove. He stared at the open palm of his left hand for a long time. That 10-year-old girl grasped this hand and hugely changed something inside me. But I can't give a reasonable explanation of how such a thing could have happened. Still, the two of us understood each other and accepted each other in a very natural way, in every last particular, almost miraculously so. Such things don't happen all that often in this life. For some people, they might never happen. At the time, however, Tengo had not been able to fully comprehend the event's decisive meaning. And not just back then. He had not truly been able to understand its meaning until almost the present moment. He had only vaguely embraced the girl's image in his heart over the years. She was 30 now, and her outward appearance might be very different from what he remembered from when they were 10. She must have grown taller, her chest developed, and her hairstyle must have changed. If she left the society of witnesses, she was probably wearing makeup. She might be sporting expensive, stylish clothing. Tengo found it hard to imagine Aomami striding down the street wearing a Calvin Klein suit and high heels, but such a thing was, of course, conceivable. People grow up, and when they grow up, they change. She could be in this bar right this moment without my realizing it. Tipping back his beer glass, Tengo took another look at his surroundings. She was somewhere close by, within walking distance. Fukaeri said so. And Tengo accepted Fukaeri at her word. If she said it, it must be true. The only other customers in the room were a young couple, probably students, sitting at the bar, engaged in an intense and intimate conversation, their foreheads practically touching. Seeing them, Tengo felt a profound loneliness, the sort he had not experienced for a very long time. "I'm alone in this world," he thought. "I have no ties with anyone." Tengo closed his eyes and concentrated on the elementary school classroom once again. He had closed his eyes and visited that place last night, too, with a tremendously concrete sense of reality, when he and Fukaeri joined bodies during the violent thunderstorm. Because of that, the picture he conjured now came back with special vividness, as if it had been cleansed of all dust by last night's rain. Unease and expectation and fear scattered to the farthest corners of the spacious classroom and hid themselves in the room's many objects like cowardly little animals. Tengo was able to recreate the scene in meticulous detail, the blackboard with its partially erased mathematical formulas, the broken pieces of chalk, the cheap, sun-damaged curtains, the flowers in the vase on the teacher's podium, though he couldn't tell what type, the children's paintings pinned to the wall, the world map behind the podium, the smell of the floor wax, the waving of the curtains, the children's shouts coming through the window. His eyes could trace each omen or plan or riddle they contained. During those several seconds when Aomami was holding his hand, Tengo had seen many things and accurately seared each image on his retinas, like a camera taking a photograph. These images comprised one of the basic landscapes that helped him survive his pain-filled teens. The scene always included the strong sensation of the girl's fingers. Her right hand never failed to encourage Tengo during the agonizing process of becoming an adult. "Don't worry, I'm with you," the hand declared. "You are not alone." "She is in hiding," Fukaeri had said, "like a wounded cat." Come to think of it, this was a strange coincidence. Fukaeri herself was in hiding here. She wouldn't set foot outside of Tengo's apartment. In this same section of Tokyo, two women were lying low, running away from something. Both women had deep connections with Tengo. Could that be significant? Or was it a mere coincidence? No answers were forthcoming, of course, just an aimless bunch of questions. Too many questions, too few answers. It was always like this. When he finished his beer, a young waiter came over and asked him if he would like something else. Tengo hesitated a moment and then requested a bourbon on the rocks and another bowl of mixed nuts. "The only bourbon we have is Four Roses, if that's okay." Tengo said it would be okay. Anything at all. Then he went back to thinking about Aomami. The fragrance of a baking pizza wafted toward him from the kitchen. From whom could Aomami possibly be hiding? The police? But Tengo could not believe that she had become a criminal. What kind of crime could she have committed? No, it could not be the police who were chasing her. Whoever or whatever it might be, the law surely had nothing to do with it. Maybe they're the same ones who are after Fukaeri, it suddenly occurred to Tengo. The little people? Why would the little people have to pursue Aomami? But if they are really the ones pursuing Aomami, am I at the center of this? Tengo, of course, had no idea why he had to be the pivotal figure in such a chain of events, but if there was a connection between the two women, Fukaeri and Aomami, it could not be anyone other than Tengo himself. Without even being aware of it, I may have been using some kind of power to draw Aomami closer to me. Some kind of power. He stared at his hands. I don't get it. Where could I have that kind of power? His four roses on the rocks arrived, along with a new bowl of nuts. He took a swallow of four roses, and, taking several nuts in the palm of his hand, he shook them like dice. Anyhow, Aomami is in this neighborhood, within walking distance. That's what Fukaeri says, and I believe it. I'd be hard-pressed to explain why, but I do believe it. Still, how can I go about finding Aomami in her hiding place? It's hard enough finding someone living a normal life, but the task obviously becomes more challenging when somebody is deliberately hiding. Should I go through the streets, calling her name on a loudspeaker? Sure, like that's going to get her to step right up. It would just alert others to her presence and expose her to added danger. There must be something else I should recall about her, Tengo thought. You remember some things about her. One of them might help, Fukaeri had said. But even before she said that to him, Tengo had long suspected that he might have failed to recall an important fact or two regarding Aomami. It had begun to make him feel uneasy now and then, like a pebble in his shoe. The feeling was vague, but persistent. Tengo swept his mind clean, as if erasing a blackboard, and started unearthing memories again. Memories of Aomami, memories of himself, memories of the things around them. Dredging the soft, muddy bottom like a fisherman dragging his net, putting the items in order and mulling them over with great care. Ultimately, though, these were things that had happened 20 years earlier. As vividly as he might recall them, there was a limit to how much he could bring back. It occurred to him to try thinking about lines of vision. What had Aomami been looking at? And what had Tengo himself been looking at? Let me think back along our moving lines of vision and the flow of time. The girl was holding his hand and looking straight into his eyes. Her line of vision never wavered. Tengo, initially at a loss to understand her actions, sought an explanation in her eyes. This must be some kind of misunderstanding or mistake, Tengo had thought. But there was no misunderstanding or mistake here. What he realized was that the girl's eyes were almost shockingly deep and clear. He had never seen eyes of such absolute clarity. They were like two springs, utterly transparent, but too deep to see the bottoms. He felt he might be sucked inside if he went on looking into them, and so he had no choice but to turn away from them. He looked first at the floorboards beneath his feet, then at the entrance to the empty classroom, and finally he bent his neck slightly to look outside through the window. All this time Aomame's gaze never wavered. She kept staring at Tengo's eyes even as he looked outside the window. He could feel her line of vision stinging his skin and her fingers gripping his left hand with unwavering strength and with complete conviction. She was not afraid. There was nothing she had to fear, and she was trying to convey that feeling to Tengo through her fingertips. Because their encounter followed the cleaning of the classroom, the window had been left wide open for fresh air, and the white curtains were softly waving in the breeze. Beyond them stretched the sky. December had come, but it was still not that cold. High up in the sky floated a cloud, a straight white cloud that retained a vestige of autumn, like a brand new brushstroke across the sky. And there was something else there, hanging beneath the cloud. The sun? No, it was not the sun. Tengo held his breath, pressed his fingers to his temple, and tried to peer into a still deeper place in his memory, tracing a frail thread of consciousness that was ready to snap at any moment. That's it. The moon was up there. Sunset was still some time away, but there it was, the moon, standing out against the sky, about three-quarters full. Tenga was impressed that he could see such a large, bright moon while it was still so light out. He remembered that. The unfeeling chunk of rock hung low in the sky, as if, having nothing better to do, it was suspended on an invisible thread. It had a certain artificial air about it. At first glance it looked like a fake moon used as a stage prop. But it was the actual moon, of course. Nobody would take the time and effort to hang a fake moon in a real sky. Suddenly, Tengo realized that Aomami was no longer looking at him. Her line of vision was turned in the same direction as his. Like him, Aomami was staring at the moon in broad daylight, still gripping his hand, her face deadly serious. He looked at her eyes again. They were not as clear as before. That had been a special momentary clarity, and in its place he now could see something hard and crystalline. It was at once beguiling and severe, with a quality reminiscent of frost. Tengo could not grasp its meaning. Eventually the girl seemed to have made up her mind. She suddenly released her grip on his hand, turned her back on him, and rushed out of the room without a word or a backward glance, leaving Tengo in a deep vacuum. Tengo opened his eyes, relaxed his mental concentration, released a deep breath, and took a swallow of his bourbon. He felt the whiskey pass through his throat and down his gullet. He took another breath and exhaled. He could no longer see Aomami. She had turned her back on him and left the classroom, erasing herself from his life. 20 years went by. It was the moon, Tengo thought. I was looking at the moon, and so was Aomami. That gray chunk of rock hanging in the still bright sky at 3:30 in the afternoon. That lonely, taciturn satellite. We stood side by side, looking at that moon. But what does it mean? That the moon will guide me to her? It suddenly crossed Tengo's mind that back then Aomami might have entrusted the moon with her feelings. She and the moon might have reached a kind of secret agreement. Her gaze at the moon contained something frighteningly serious that could stir the imagination this way. Tengo had no idea, of course, what Aomami had offered to the moon that time, but he could well imagine what the moon had given her. Pure solitude and tranquility. That was the best thing the moon could give a person. Tengo paid his bill and walked out of the barley head. Then he looked up at the sky, but could not find the moon. The sky was clear, and the moon should be up, but it could not be seen from street level with buildings all around. Hands thrust in his pockets, Tengo walked from one street to the next, looking for the moon. He wanted to go someplace with an open field of vision, but finding such a place in a neighborhood like Koenji was no easy matter. The area was so flat that finding even a slight incline involved a major effort, and there were no hills at all. The best place might be the roof of a tall building with a view in all directions, but he couldn't see the kind of building in the area that let people up to the roof. As he went on, walking around aimlessly, Tengo recalled that there was a playground nearby, one that he often passed on walks. It was not a large playground, but it probably had a slide. If he climbed that, he should be able to have a better view of the sky. It wasn't a tall slide, but the view should be better than from street level. He headed for the playground. His watch hands were pointing to nearly 8 o'clock. There was no one in the playground. A tall mercury vapor lamp stood in the middle, illuminating every corner of the place. There was a large zelk of a tree, its leaves still thick and luxuriant. There were several low shrubs, a water fountain, a bench, swings, and a slide. There was also a public toilet, but it had been locked by a worker at sunset, perhaps to keep vagrants out. During the daytime, young mothers brought their children, who were not yet old enough for kindergarten, and kept up their lively chattering while the children played. Tengo had observed such scenes any number of times. Once the sun went down, however, almost no one visited this place. Tengo climbed the slide, and, still standing, looked up at the night sky. A new 6-story condo stood on the north side of the park. He had never noticed it before. It must have been built quite recently. It blocked the northern sky like a wall. Only low buildings stood on the other three sides of the playground. Tengo turned to scan the area and found the moon in the southwest, hanging over an old two-story house. It was about three-quarters full. Just like the moon of 20 years ago, Tengo thought. Exactly the same size and shape. A complete coincidence. Probably. But this bright moon, hanging in the early autumn night sky, had sharp, clear outlines and the introspective warmth characteristic of this season. The impression it gave was very different from that of the moon at 3:30 in the December afternoon sky. Its calm, natural glow had the power to soothe and heal the heart like the flow of clear water or the gentle stirring of tree leaves. Standing at the very top of the slide, Tengo looked up at that moon for a very long time. From the direction of Ring Road 7 came the blended sound of different-sized tires, like the roar of the sea. All at once, the sound reminded Tengo of the sanatorium where his father was staying on the Chiba shore. The city's earthly lights blotted out the stars, as always. The sky was nice and clear, but only a few stars were visible, the very bright ones that twinkled as pale points here and there. Still, the moon stood out clearly against the sky. It hung up there faithfully, without a word of complaint concerning the city lights, or the noise, or the air pollution. If he focused hard on the moon, he could make out the strange shadows formed by its gigantic craters and valleys. Tengo's mind emptied as he stared at the light of the moon. Inside him, memories that had been handed down from antiquity began to stir. Before human beings possessed fire, or tools, or language, the moon had been their ally. It would calm people's fears now and then by illuminating the dark world like a heavenly lantern. Its waxing and waning gave people an understanding of the concept of time. Even now, when darkness had been banished from most parts of the world, there remained a sense of human gratitude toward the moon and its unconditional compassion. It was imprinted upon human genes like a warm collective memory. "Come to think of it, I haven't looked hard at the moon like this for a very long while," Tengo thought. "When could the last time have been? Living one hectic day after another in the city, you tend to look down at the ground. You forget to even look at the night sky." It was then that Tengo realized there was another moon hanging in the sky. At first he thought it might be an optical illusion, a mere trick of light rays. But the more he looked at it, the surer he became that there was a second moon with solid outlines up there. His mind went blank as he stared in its direction, open-mouthed. "What am I seeing?" He could not make up his mind. The outline and the substance refused to overlap, as when word and concept fail to cohere. Another moon? He closed his eyes, opened his palms, and rubbed his cheeks. "What's wrong with me? I didn't drink that much." He drew in a long, quiet breath, and then quietly expelled it. He checked to be sure his mind was clear. "Who am I? Where am I now? What am I doing?" he asked himself in the darkness behind his closed eyelids. "It's September 1984. I'm Tengo Kawana. I'm in a playground in Koenji in Suginami Ward, and I'm looking up at the moon in the night sky. No doubt about it." Then he slowly opened his eyes and looked at the sky again, carefully, his mind calm. But still, there were two moons. "This is no illusion. There are two moons." Tengo balled his hand into a fist and kept it that way for a long time. The moon was as taciturn as ever, but it was no longer alone.
Chapter 19. Aomame. When the Daughter Wakes Up. Air Chrysalis was a fantastical story, but it took the form of a very readable novella, narrated from beginning to end in a simple colloquial style, by a 10-year-old girl. It was not overly complex in terms of its vocabulary or logic, and it did not contain long-winded explanations or wordy expressions. The words and style of the young narrator were universally appealing, concise, and in most cases, pleasant, but they explained almost nothing about the events that unfolded. Rather, the girl simply let the narrative flow as she recounted what she had seen with her own eyes, never stopping to consider, what is going on here? Or what could this mean? The book moved forward at an easy pace, appropriate to the story she was telling. Her readers followed along, very naturally adopting her point of view, and before they knew it, they were in another world. A world that was not this world. A world in which the little people made air chrysalises. Reading the first 10 pages, Al-Mame felt herself responding strongly to the novel style. If indeed this was Tengo's creation, he was certainly a talented writer. The Tengo that Al-Mame knew was primarily a mathematical genius. He was said to be a prodigy, easily able to solve mathematical problems that were too difficult for most adults. His grades had been outstanding in other subjects too, if not quite up to his work in mathematics. He was also physically big and an all-around athlete, but Al-Mame did not recall anything about his being an especially good writer. Probably that talent was obscured at the time in the shadow of his mathematics. On the other hand, Tengo might have done nothing more than transfer the author's narrative voice to the page, just as he had initially read it. His own originality might not have contributed much of anything to the style. She felt, though, that this was not the case. While the writing was deceptively simple, a closer read revealed that it was in fact calculated and arranged with great care. No part of it was overwritten, but at the same time, it had everything it needed. Figurative expressions were kept to a minimum, but the descriptions were still vivid and richly colored. Above all, the style had a wonderfully musical quality. Even without reading it aloud, the reader could recognize its deep sonority. This was not writing that flowed naturally from the pen of a 17-year-old girl. Having ascertained all this, Al-Mame proceeded to read the rest with great care. The heroine is a young girl. She belongs to a small mountain community known as The Gathering. Her mother and father live a communal life in The Gathering. She has no brothers or sisters. Because she was brought here shortly after her birth, the girl has virtually no knowledge of the outside world. All three members of the family have busy schedules that give them little opportunity to spend time together in relaxed conversation, but still they are close. The girl spends her days in the local elementary school, while her parents are primarily engaged in farm work. The children also help with the farming when they have free time. The adults of The Gathering all hate the outside world. At every opportunity, they like to say that the world in which they live is a beautiful, solitary island floating in a sea of capitalism, a fortress. The girl does not know what they mean by capitalism, or the other word they sometimes use, materialism. But, judging from the scornful tone they use whenever they speak the words, capitalism and materialism must be very twisted things that are opposed to nature and rightness. The girl has been taught that, in order to keep her body and her thoughts clean, she must limit her contact with the outside world. Otherwise, her mind will become polluted. The gathering is composed of some 50 relatively young men and women divided into two groups. One group aims at revolution, while the other group aims at peace. The girl's parents tend to belong to the peace group. Her father is the oldest member of that group, and he has played a central role since the founding of The Gathering. The 10-year-old girl cannot, of course, give a logical explanation of the opposition of the two groups, nor does she understand the difference between revolution and peace. She has only the vague impression that revolution is a kind of pointed way of thinking, while peace has a rather more rounded shape. Each way of thinking has its own shape and color, which wax and wane like the moon. That is about all she understands. The girl does not know much about how the gathering came into being either. She has been told that, almost 10 years earlier, just after she was born, there was a big movement in society, and people stopped living in the city and came out to an isolated village in the mountains. She does not know much about the city. She has never ridden on a subway or taken an elevator. She has never seen a building with more than 3 stories. There is just too much she doesn't know about. All she can understand are the things around her that she can see and touch. Still, the girl's low-angled line of vision and unadorned narrative voice vividly and naturally depict the small community called The Gathering, its makeup and scenery, and the customs and ways of thinking of the people who live there. Despite the split in the residents' ways of thinking, their sense of solidarity is strong. They share the conviction that it is good to live separately from capitalism, and they are well aware that even though the shape and color of their ways of thinking may differ, they have to stand together if they hope to survive. They are barely able to make ends meet. People work hard every day without a break. They grow vegetables, barter with the neighboring villages, sell their surplus products, avoid the use of mass-produced items as much as possible, and generally spend their lives in nature. When they must use an electrical appliance, they find one in a pile of discards somewhere and repair it. Almost all the clothes they wear are used items sent to them from somewhere else. Some members of the community, unable to adapt to this pure but difficult life, eventually leave the gathering, but others come to join it. New members outnumber those who leave, and so the gathering's population gradually increases. This is a welcome trend. The abandoned village in which they make their life has many homes that can be lived in with few repairs, and many fields remaining that can be farmed. The community is delighted to have new workers. The number of children in the community varies between 8 and 10. Most of the children were born in the gathering. The eldest child is a heroine of the story, the girl. The children attend a local elementary school, walking together to and from the school each day. They are required by law to attend a school in the district, and the gathering's founders believe that preserving good relations with the people of the district is indispensable to the survival of the community. The local children, however, are unnerved by the children of the gathering, and they either avoid them or bully them, as a result of which the gathering children move as one. They stay together to protect themselves, both from physical harm and from pollution of the mind. Quite separate from the district public school, the gathering has its own school, and members take turns teaching the children. This is not a great burden, since most of the members are highly educated, and several of them hold teaching certificates. They make their own textbooks and teach the children basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. They also teach the basics of chemistry, physics, physiology, biology, and the workings of the outside world. The world has 2 systems, capitalism and communism, that hate each other. Both systems, though, have big problems, so the world is generally moving in a direction that is not good. Communism was originally an outstanding ideology with high ideals, but it was twisted out of shape by self-serving politicians. The girl was shown a photograph of one of the self-serving politicians. With his big nose and big black beard, the man made her think of the king of the devils. There is no television in the gathering, and listening to the radio is not allowed except on special occasions. Newspapers and magazines are also limited. News that is considered necessary is reported orally during dinner at the assembly hall. The people respond to each item of news with cheers or groans, far more often with groans. This is the girl's only experience of media. She has never seen a movie. She has never read a cartoon. She is only allowed to listen to classical music. There is a stereo set in the assembly hall, and lots of records that someone probably brought in as a single collection. During free moments, it is possible to listen to a Brahms symphony, or Schumann piano piece, or Bach keyboard music, or religious music. These are precious moments for the girl, and virtually her only entertainment. Then one day, something happens that makes it necessary for the girl to be punished. She has been ordered that week to take care of the gathering small herd of goats each morning and night. But, overwhelmed with her homework and other daily chores, one night it slips her mind. The next morning, the oldest animal, a blind goat, is found cold and dead. As her punishment, the girl is to be isolated from the rest of the gathering for 10 days. That particular goat was thought by the community to have a special significance. But it was quite old, and some kind of illness had sunk its talons into the goat's wasted body, so whether anyone took care of it or not, there was no hope it would recover. Still, that does not lessen the severity of the girl's crime in any way. She is blamed not only for the death of the goat itself, but for the dereliction of her duties. Isolation is one of the most serious punishments that the gathering can impose. The girl is locked in a small, old earthen storehouse with the dead blind goat. The storehouse is called the Room for Reflection. Anyone who has broken the gathering's rules goes there in order to reflect upon his or her offense. No one speaks to the girl while she is in isolation. She must endure 10 full days of total silence. A minimal amount of water and food is brought to her, but the storehouse is dark, cold and damp, and it smells of the dead goat. The door is locked from the outside. In one corner of the room is a bucket where she can relieve herself. High on one wall is a small window that admits the light of the sun and the moon. A few stars can also be seen through it when the sky is not clouded over. There is no other light. She stretches out on the hard mattress on top of the board floor, wraps herself in 2 old blankets, and spends the night shivering. It is April, but the nights are cold in the mountains. When darkness falls, the dead goat's eye sparkles in the starlight. Afraid, the girl can hardly sleep. On the third night, the goat's mouth opens wide. It has been pushed open from the inside, and out of the mouth comes a number of tiny people, 6 in all. They are only 4 inches high when they first emerge, but as soon as they set foot on the ground, they begin to grow like mushrooms sprouting after the rain. Even so, they are no more than 2 feet tall. They tell the girl that they are called the Little People. This is like Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, the girl thinks, recalling a story her father read to her when she was little. But there's one missing. "If you'd rather have 7, we can be 7. One of the little people says to her in a soft voice. Apparently they can read her mind. She counts them again, and now there are 7. The girl does not find this especially strange, however. The rules of the world had already changed when the little people came out of the goat's mouth. Anything could happen after that. "Why did you come out of the dead goat's mouth?" she asks, noticing that her voice sounds odd. Her manner of speaking is also different from usual, probably because she has not spoken with anyone for 3 days.
Because the goat's mouth turned into a passageway,
one of the little people with a hoarse voice says.
We didn't know it was a dead goat until we actually came out.
A screechy-voiced one adds.
We don't mind at all, though. A goat? A whale? A pea pod? As long as it's a passageway.
You made the passageway, so we thought we'd give it a try and see where it came out,
the soft-voiced one says. I made the passageway? The girl says. No, it does not sound like her own voice.
You did us a favor,
says one of the little people with a small voice. Some of the others voice their agreement.
Let's play, says one with a tenor voice. Let's make an air chrysalis.
Yes, replies the baritone, since we went to all the trouble of coming here.
An air chrysalis?
The girl asks.
We pluck threads out of the air and make a home. We make it bigger and bigger, the bass says.
A home? Who is it for? The girl asks.
You'll see, the baritone says. You'll see when it comes out,
the bass says.
Ho, ho,
another one takes up the beat.
Can I help? The girl asks.
Of course,
the hoarse one says.
You did us a favor, the tenor says. Let's work together.
Once the girl begins to get the hang of it, plucking threads out of the air is not too difficult. She has always been good with her hands, so she is able to master this operation right away. If you look closely, there are lots of threads hanging in the air. You can see them if you try.
Yes, that's it. You're doing it right,
the small-voiced one says.
You're a very clever girl. You learn quickly,
says the screechy-voiced one. All the little people wear the same clothing and their faces look alike, but each one has a distinctively different voice. The clothing they wear is utterly ordinary, the kind that can be seen anywhere. This is an odd way to put it, but there is no other way to describe their clothing. Once you take your eyes off their clothes, you can't possibly remember what they looked like. The same can be said of their faces, the features of which are neither good nor bad. They are just ordinary features, the kind that can be seen anywhere. Once you take your eyes off their faces, you can't possibly remember what they looked like. It is the same with their hair, which is neither long nor short, just ordinary hair. One thing they do not have is any smell. When the dawn comes and the cock crows and the eastern sky lightens, the 7 little people stop working and begin stretching. Then they hide the partially finished air chrysalis, which is only about the size of a baby rabbit, in the corner of the room, probably so that the person who brings the meals will not see it.
It's morning, says the one with the small voice.
The night has ended, says the bass.
Since they have all these different voices, they ought to form a chorus, the girl thinks.
We have no songs, says the tenor.
Ho, ho, says the keeper of the beat.
The little people all shrink down to their original 4-inch size, form a line, and enter the dead goat's mouth.
We'll be back tonight,
the small-voiced one says before closing the goat's mouth from the inside.
You must not tell anyone about us.
If you do tell someone about us, something very bad will happen,
the hoarse one adds for good measure.
Ho, ho, says the keeper of the beat.
I won't tell anyone, the girl says.
And even if I did, they wouldn't believe me.
The girl has often been scolded by the grown-ups around her for saying what is in her mind. People have said that she does not distinguish between reality and her imagination. The shape and color of her thoughts seem to be very different from those of other people. She can't understand what they consider so wrong about her. In any case, she had better not tell anyone,
about the little people.
After the little people have disappeared and the goat's mouth has closed, the girl does a thorough search of the area where they hid the air chrysalis. But she is unable to find it. They did such a good job of hiding it. The space is confined, but still she can't discover where it might be. Where could they have hidden it? After that, she wraps herself in the blankets and goes to sleep. Her first truly restful sleep in a long time. No dreams, no interruptions. She enjoys the unusually deep sleep. The dead goat stays dead all day, its body stiff, its eyes clouded like marbles. When the sun goes down, though, and darkness comes to the storehouse, the eye sparkles in the starlight, the mouth snaps open, and the little people emerge, as if guided by the light. This time there are 7 from the beginning.
"Let's pick up where we left off last night,"
the hoarse-voiced one says. Each of the other 6 voices his approval in his own way. The 7 little people and the girl sit in a circle around the chrysalis and continue to work on it, plucking white threads from the air and adding them to the chrysalis. They hardly speak, concentrating their energies on the job. Engrossed in moving her hands, the girl is not bothered by the night's coldness. She is hardly aware of the passing time, and she feels neither bored nor sleepy. The chrysalis grows in size, slowly but visibly.
"How big are we going to make it?"
the girl asks when dawn is nearing. She wants to know if the job will be done within the 10 days she is locked in the storehouse.
"As big as we can,"
the screechy-voiced one replies.
"When it gets to a certain size, it will break open all by itself,"
the tenor says gleefully.
"And something will come out,"
the baritone says in vibrant tones.
"What kind of thing?" the girl asks.
"What will come out?"
the small-voiced one says.
"Just you wait,"
the bass says.
"Ho, ho," says the keeper of the beat.
"Ho, ho," the other 6 join in. A peculiar darkness pervaded the novella's style. As she became aware of it, Almame frowned slightly. This was like a fabulous children's story, but hidden down deep somewhere, it had a strong, dark undercurrent. Almame could hear its ominous rumble beneath the story's simple phrases, a gloomy suggestion of illness to come, a deadly illness that quietly gnaws away a person's spirit from the core. What brought the illness with them was the chorus-like group of 7 little people.
"There's something unhealthy here, without question,"
Almame thought. And yet she could hear in their voices something that she recognized in herself, something almost fatally familiar. Almame looked up from the book and recalled what Leader had said about the little people before he died.
"We have lived with them since long, long ago, from a time before good and evil even existed, when people's minds were still benighted."
Almame went on reading the story. The little people and the girl continue working, and after several days, the air chrysalis has grown to something like the size of a large dog.
"My punishment ends tomorrow. After that, I'll get out of here,"
the girl says to the little people as dawn is beginning to break. The 7 little people listen quietly to what the girl is telling them.
"So I won't be able to make the air chrysalis with you anymore."
"We are very sorry to hear that,"
the tenor says, sounding genuinely sorry.
"You helped us very much,"
the baritone says. The one with the screechy voice says,
"But the chrysalis is almost finished. It will be ready once we add just a little bit more."
The little people stand in a row, staring at the air chrysalis as if to measure the size of what they have made so far.
"Just a tiny bit more,"
the hoarse-voiced one says, as if leading the chorus in a monotonous boatman's song.
Ho, ho, intones the keeper of the beat.
Ho, ho,
the other six join in. The girl's 10 days of isolation end, and she returns to the gathering. Her communal life starts again, and she is so busy following all the rules that she has no more time to be alone. She can, of course, no longer work on the air chrysalis with the little people. Every night before she goes to bed, she imagines to herself the 7 little people continuing to sit around the air chrysalis and make it bigger. It is all she can think about. It even feels as if the whole air chrysalis has actually slipped inside her head. The girl is dying to know what could possibly be inside the air chrysalis. What will appear when the chrysalis ripens and pops open? She is filled with regret to think that she cannot witness the scene with her own eyes. I worked so hard helping them make it. I should be allowed to be there when it opens. She even thinks seriously of committing another offense so that she can be punished with another period of isolation in the storehouse. But even if she were to go to all that trouble, the little people might not appear. The dead goat has been carried away and buried somewhere. Its eye will not sparkle in the starlight again. The story goes on to describe the girl's daily life in the community, the discipline schedule, the fixed tasks, the guidance and care she provides the other children as the oldest child in the community, her simple meals, the stories her parents read her before bedtime, the classical music she listens to whenever she can find a spare moment. A life without pollution. The little people visit her in dreams. They can enter people's dreams whenever they like. They tell her that the air chrysalis is about to break open, and they urge her to come and see it. Come to the storehouse with a candle after sunset. Don't let anyone see you. The girl cannot suppress her curiosity. She slips out of bed and pads her way to the storehouse carrying the candle she has prepared. No one is there. All she finds is the air chrysalis, sitting quietly where it has been left on the storehouse floor. It is twice as big as it was when she last saw it, well over 4 feet long. Its entire surface radiates a soft glow, and its beautifully curved shape has a waist-like narrowed area in the middle that was not there before, when it was smaller. The little people have obviously been working hard. The chrysalis is already breaking open. A vertical crack has formed in its side. The girl bends over and peers in through the opening. She discovers that she herself is inside the chrysalis. She stares at this other self of hers lying naked on her back, eyes closed, apparently unconscious, not breathing, like a doll. One of the little people speaks to her, the one with the hoarse voice.
That is your daughter,
he says, and then clears his throat. The girl turns to find the 7 little people fanned out behind her in a row. Daughter, she says, mechanically repeating the word.
And what you are called is Maza, the bass says.
Maza and Dota, the girl says.
The Dota serves as a stand-in for the Maza,
the screechy-voiced one says.
Do I get split in two?
The girl asks.
Not at all, the tenor says. This does not mean that you are split in two. You are the same you in every way. Don't worry. A Dota is just the shadow of the Maza's heart and mind, in the shape of the Maza.
When will she wake up?
Very soon, when the time comes,
the baritone says.
What will this Dota do as the shadow of my heart and mind? The girl asks.
She will act as a perceiver,
the small-voiced one says furtively.
Perceiver, the girl says.
Yes,
says a hoarse one.
She who perceives.
She conveys what she perceives to the receiver, the screechy one says.
In other words, the dota becomes our passageway,
the tenor says. Instead of the goat? The girl asks.
The dead goat was only a temporary passageway, the bass says. We must have a living dota as a perceiver to link the place we live with this place.
What does the maza do? The girl asks.
The maza stays close to the dota,
the screechy one says.
When will the dota wake up? The girl asks. 2 days from now, or maybe three,
the tenor says.
One or the other,
says the one with the small voice.
Make sure you take good care of this dota, the baritone says. She is your dota.
Without the maza's care, the dota cannot be complete. She cannot live long without it,
the screechy one says.
If she loses her dota, the maza will lose the shadow of her heart and mind,
the tenor says.
What happens to a maza when she loses the shadow of her heart and mind? The girl asks.
The little people look at each other. None of them will answer the question.
When the dota wakes up, there will be 2 moons in the sky,
the hoarse one says.
The 2 moons cast the shadow of her heart and mind,
the baritone says.
There will be 2 moons,
the girl repeats mechanically.
That will be a sign. Watch the sky with great care,
the small-voiced one says furtively.
Watch the sky with great care,
he says again.
Count the moons.
Ho, ho, says the keeper of the beat. Ho, ho.
The other 6 join in. The girl runs away. There was something mistaken there. Something wrong. Something greatly misshapen. Something opposed to nature. The girl knows this. She does not know what the little people want, but the image of herself inside the air chrysalis sends shivers through her. She cannot possibly live with her living, moving other self. She has to run away from here, as soon as she possibly can, before her dota wakes up, before that second moon appears in the sky. In the gathering, it is forbidden for individuals to own money, but the girl's father once secretly gave her a 10,000 yen bill and some coins. Hide this so that no one can find it, he told her. He also gave her a piece of paper with someone's name, address, and telephone number written on it. If you ever have to run away from this place, use the money to buy a train ticket and go there. Her father must have known back then that something bad might happen in the gathering. The girl does not hesitate. Her actions are swift. She has no time to say goodbye to her parents. From a jar she buried in the earth, she takes out the 10,000 yen bill and the coins and the paper. During class, she tells the teacher she is not feeling well and gets permission to go to the nurse's office. Instead, she leaves the school and takes a bus to the station. She presents her 10,000 yen bill at the window and buys a ticket to Takao, west of Tokyo. The man at the window gives her change. This is the first time in her life she has ever bought a ticket or received change or gotten on a train. But her father gave her detailed instructions, and she has memorized what she must do. As indicated on the paper, the girl gets off the train at Takao Station on the Chuo line, and she uses a public telephone to call the number her father gave her. The man who answers is an old friend of her father's, an artist who paints in the traditional Japanese style. He is 10 years older than her father, and he lives in the hills with his daughter near Mount Takao. His wife died a short time before. The daughter is named Kurumi, and she is 1 year younger than the girl. As soon as he hears from the girl, the man comes to get her at the station, and he warmly welcomes this young escapee into his home.
The day after she is taken into the painter's home, the girl looks at the sky from her room and discovers that the number of moons up there has increased to 2.